Welcome to the Audible Life Magazine podcast. I'm Dan Donovan. Today our guest is Tasha Carradine, the co-campaign chair for Jean Charest's Conservative Leadership Campaign and principal of Navigator. Tasha is also the author of The Right Path, How Conservatives Can Unite, Inspire, and Take Canada Forward. Hi, Tasha. Wonderful to have you on the show today. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Dan.
Pierre Poilievre won the Conservative race. Now, prior to the election, you were hopeful for a Charest win, obviously, as co-campaign chair for Charest. So when they announced that Pierre Poilievre was the new leader, what were your initial feelings, emotion, thought, when you first saw the result?
Well, of course, I was disappointed for my candidate, because when you're in a leadership race, you want your candidate to win and you're fighting very hard. This was a long race, very emotional and sometimes fraught one. The result, however, was extremely decisive in favor of Mr. Poilievre, which was something that was not fully expected. Be honest with you, our numbers were different than what we saw in terms of the decisiveness. I did at the end think that he was going to win. But what that means is, it means for the party, he has a clear mandate. And in a way, you know, that's actually a good thing, because it means that the party will no longer be subject to the divisions that we've seen for the past 8 months. It allows us to continue. And I think a lot of us now we're going to turn the page and find the ways to bring the family together and fight the real adversary, which is, of course, the Liberals and Justin Trudeau.
So would I be accurate in saying that you can row in that boat?
I started rowing actually the day after. I was with Lisa Raitt, the former minister under Stephen Harper. I've been a conservative for forever almost. I joined the Progressive Conservative Party when I was 14. So it's something that's in my DNA. I do believe that, especially given the remarks that Mr. Poilievre made the night that he won, that there is a sense of reaching out. He gave a speech which really did hit a lot of the common points that conservatives of all the camps in this leadership had, while leaving out the more contentious ones that were dividing people. So that was an encouraging sign.
Well, your comments are interesting to me, because you're as a co-chair for the Charest campaign, and I know you're also a personal friend of Jean Charest. And, you know, in my milieu, you know, into my way of thinking, Jean Charest is probably one of the greatest political figures in our country's history. And I say that only because of not only his service to the country, but as you will recall, in the 1995 referendum, I believe this, as millions of other Canadians do, that if it wasn't for Jean Charest, the Federalists would not have won that referendum. So I noted last night that in Pierre Poilievre's remarks, he had some very kind words to say about Mr. Charest. But the thing that caught me actually was he went further, and he also had some very nice things to say about Michelle Charest, Jean Charest's spouse, and who's been with him through it all. Can you just give me your thoughts on that?
Yes. And again, that was a good thing for Mr. Poilievre to do. It was a leaderly thing. The kind of step that shows a human approach to politics that is necessary too. Politics isn't just about ideas, it's about relationships too. If you're going to build those bridges, you have to show the human face and have that human face. And I think that was a good thing to do. And I think, speculating here, I am actually speculating, but I'm hazarding a guess that, Mr. Poilievre's wife, his own wife, Anita, has been with him at most of his rallies and throughout this campaign. She spoke, in fact, before he did, after he was named the leader. And she is clearly a great asset to him personally and to the party as well. She's extremely well-spoken and very passionate about supporting him and supporting the Conservatives. So maybe there was a bit of a kinship there. I mean, Michelle Dionne has been a rock. She is an incredible woman. She has been by Jean Charest's side for 40 years, supporting him. But also, you know, she's beloved in the Conservative Party. She is gone, not, you know, just as his spouse, but as a true partner to all the events throughout this leadership and throughout his career, really, that, you know, he needed to have support at. And also she, I think, honestly enjoyed it. She's, like I said, a wonderful person. She has such a great touch with people. And perhaps it was a nod to that, to the importance of political spouses who sometimes don't get the credit really for being behind the scenes or at the side, but who are incredibly important in terms of the candidate, not just their public face, but also in private when, you know, the chips are down or you need advice or you need that pep talk. It's your spouse or your partner who can give you that. And it's a very precious thing. So it was nice of him to acknowledge that for sure.
And I should acknowledge me bad there because I did mean Michelle Dionne, but I said Michelle Chappé, but I think
she'll forgive you. She's that kind of person. Okay, she'd be that's okay. Great.
And, you know, it's interesting that you spoke about Pierre Poilievre's spouse. She is very articulate and gave a great speech and did a great job in introducing him, I thought. What were your thoughts about that rather unconventional thing?
Well, she's been doing it, like I said, throughout the campaign. I've mm-hmm. attended rallies and events at which Mr. Poilievre was, you know, his events that he had as well. She's done that at every one that I've seen. She's expressed, you know, her not only support for him, but talked about her personal story, that of her family. She comes from an immigrant background. Her father came here from Venezuela and they were very poor to start. They had to leave everything behind and start over. And she talks about that, which resonates very well with new Canadians, a lot of people who've come from difficult backgrounds who've had to remake their lives here. So yeah, it was unconventional, but she pulled it off. In fact, some people were saying she's a better candidate than he is. So you better watch out. His wife will upstage him. But, you know, he's joked about it too. I've seen him make that joke that, you know, she's the better politician kind of thing. I think it is an appealing touch.
Would you say that those can be high risk moments in politics when you do that type of a thing? Now, granted, I mean, he's been, Mr. Poilievre has been going across the country, as you note, speaking to thousands of people in halls over the last 6 months. But from a political and sort of tactical point of view, that's a very high risk moment when you have someone who does that, because there's always the possibility it could go the other way.
Sure. And, you know, the interesting model for this, of course, is Justin Trudeau. Justin yes. Trudeau and Sophie Gregoire, when he burst on the scene, she was right by his side. She also spoke. She herself is a speaker. And so she's, you know, she worked in television and media for years. And so she's a well-spoken person as well. And I think at first it was definitely well-received. It definitely helped give him that very personable, relatable touch that, you know, his background as someone who comes from a lot of privilege may not have had as much. It was the family guy and here's his beautiful wife and she's well-spoken and friendly and outgoing and all these things. However, I think over time, there was, you know, whether it's grumbling that they were too cute by half doing the cover of Vogue and this kind of, it got a bit much. Like, I think you do have to walk that line. I agree 100%. It can go sideways if you're not careful. So I think you have to be seen not to be abusing it.
Well, you know, I'd like to continue on the theme of the team around the leader. It's and you're a longstanding, you've served in politics yourself as an advisor to both federal and provincial leaders. You're a lawyer. You've advised Attorney General Ontario, I understand. You worked in the Conservative government in the early 90s as an advisor. So you've got a lot of experience on the ground, authentic experience doing this type of thing. And one of the things I observed during the leadership, as I think we could agree, in May and through parts of the summer, this was it appeared to be very toxic, very corrosive, very nasty. And people would say, well, you know, Poilievre can win in the party, but he can't, you know, and then the idea was he might win in the party, but then if he wins, can he win the country? Other people would say, look, this Poilievre guy is really good, but he's got too much of an edge. He's got to take down the edge a bit. And I thought after this last night, you know, he was so gracious. I felt in his acceptance speech, I thought, well, did he get advice or take a page from Jean Charest's book before that speech?
Well, I think, you know, this is the issue that conservatives were concerned about during the race, no question, was some of the topics that were raised by his campaign and that he seemed to personally be vested in. And, you know, Bitcoin was probably the classic example, mm-hmm. were things that were kind of out there, to put it mildly, things that either had not been policy subjects for the party ever before, but also that were things that were risky. And it's something that people were grappling with, because there are also, you know, conspiracy theories that were floated throughout this campaign, not just by him, but others that were floating around in the ether, things about the WEF and the WEO and that kind of stuff that, and I know this because I talked to people, like lots and lots and lots of people, that turned a segment of the electorate off and turned even a sector of the party off. Others were turned on by it. So it was a double-edged sword, but, you know, those kinds of things that were divisive, quite honestly. He didn't have any of that in his speech. The Pierre Poilievre we saw, like I said, was very prime ministerial. He brought forward the issues that are common to conservatives, chiefly economic ones. Things like, you know, hard work. And he took a couple of leaves too from stuff I've touched on in my book. Interesting enough, when he said, you know, people feel that they do all the right things to get ahead. They get their education, they get a job, and they're still not able to buy that house. I've used that line so many times, I can't even say. It's in my book. And also when he talked about critical minerals and the future of the party from an energy perspective and electric cars and stuff like that, which, you know, I firmly believe that's something that conservatives should be championing as a future policy for the party.
He talked about immigrants. He talked about immigrants a great deal.
Yeah. So I did hear a lot of echoes from the kinds of themes that people told me were important to them and that I put down on paper. I'm not saying he got them from my book, but I'm pleased to see that, because
I saw several themes in his speech last night that are covered in some of the chapters in your book. To be fair, he hadn't really had a lot of specific policy items in the campaign. He talked a lot about the issues. He talked about inflation and the price of housing and young people living in 400 square foot, you know, apartments and energy, but he didn't have a lot of specific policies in those areas, even on Indigenous issues, which he also spoke about last night. Whereas Mr. Charest, you know, I think maybe gave forth a bit more in the leadership.
Yeah, the campaign that Mr. Charest ran, it was our decision to do that, was to really be policy heavy, because we found that not only did we think it was important and that's what Mr. Charest wanted to do, but it was also, we got traction. Every time we put policy in the window, we got an uptick in membership sales. We got upticks in interest on our social media. People were expecting that maybe more, I don't know, from him, and they responded extremely well. And we also thought it was the responsible thing to do. I mean, this is a time when people are going to be discussing these ideas, and we need to show the Conservative Party has people with ideas in it that could go, you know, into another election and really appeal to a wide enough swath of the electorate to win. And this is the fundamental question, is that you want to get the missing pieces of the conservative that the conservatives need, whether it is, you know, they need urban and suburban voters, they need new Canadians, they need young people, millennials and Gen Z. Those are the growth opportunities for the party. And the way to get those is to find the policies that will appeal to them, the issues that matter to them, and address them in a conservative way. And this is what I feel personally as a conservative is very important. It is, there are conservative principles that are appealing on all levels, whether it's family policy, belief in freedom of enterprise or faith, the idea of community engagement. Conservatives are very much about local community, local decision-making. They're not about top-down government, but they're also not about no government. You know, this is what the misnomer is. People don't really understand that conservatives are not about just tearing stuff down. So they also
want the passport office to work.
Well, they do want, and that was a good line that he had in his speech, Mr. Poilievre, because it's clear we want the passport office to work. We want, there are basic things government is there to do, and we respect that. We just don't want them to overreach and be too broad in their involvement.
Now, Mr. Charest was very gracious in his remarks to Mr. Poilievre today, or maybe it was, sorry, right after the leadership, he said it's time for conservatives to come together. I'm paraphrasing here. Obviously, mm-hmm. you've had something to do with that, because you're his co-chair, and I'm sure you talked about it with him. It was very gracious. So would you say that Mr. Charest is going to be helpful With Mr. Polyev moving forward.
Mr. Charette is going to go back to the private sector, but continue to support the Conservative Party. So he will not be running, but he will be supportive of the party and what it does. And, you know, I spoke to him after it was all done, and he was at peace with the results and what had happened. And he knows politics. He knows what it means. Like I said, at the after a new leader is chosen, everyone gets in the tent and says, okay, let's go. Let's support him or her. Let's go forward and make this work. So he's going to do that. He's just not going to do it as an elected official.
In your book, and I'm just going to circle around to what you've just said, because in your book, you spent some time talking about Stephen Harper and, you know, his time in government. You've obviously, the forward in your book is by Lise Raitt, who's an exceptional woman and politician and professional in Canada. And you talk about conservatives and how they worked under Stephen Harper. They came together, they worked together, and that was so critical to their success. And during the campaign, I think you were one of the people, and there were others who were talked about this edge Polyev had, and he had to bring people together. And he seemed to start to do that after the speech. But I noticed one really interesting thing in his victory speech, which surprised me. And I thought, well, maybe the Lisa Raitt people in the party and the former Harper advisors or the smart people like John Baird, who was the co-chair of Polyev's campaign and was always voted during the Harper years. He'd have these annual votes about the most popular MP on the Hill, and it was always John Baird from Ottawa West, a Conservative MP, Foreign Affairs Minister under Stephen Harper. I noticed in his speech last night, it's a long-winded question of asking, you know, Pierre Poilievre did not mention Trudeau's name in his speech. Is that a sign that he is listening to, is taking a new direction immediately after, and he's listening to these advisors and people in a different way or going a different route? Why wouldn't he mention Trudeau's name in his speech?
Yeah, I thought that was curious too. I'm not sure. I haven't analyzed that one too much. Thinking about it as we're talking about it, I think the speech was very gracious, as you put it. It was a very prime ministerial, you know, statesman-like speech, laying out, first of all, acknowledging everyone's contribution to the race, thanking people that were close to him and that contributed to his success, and then laying forward what he saw as a path for the party to victory or to getting, you know, getting ready for the next election at the very least, and the issues that he felt it had to tackle. So it was a very constructive speech. So I mean, perhaps he just didn't want to attack, because that is his classic persona.
Yes,
I mean, everyone
exactly.
knows Pierre as the attack. Everyone will say that. I mean, he'll say it himself. He's the attack dog of the opposition. That's what he's been. But you know, he's not running to be opposition, right? He's running to be prime minister. So he's not going to be attacking the same way. He's got to also propose. He's got to have a plan. That is what a prime minister does. A prime minister is not in the House of Commons to ask the questions. He's there to answer them. So that's what he did. He answered the questions. Some of them were hanging out there. Well, what are you going to do? What's going to be, what is it? What would a Pierre Poilievre prime ministership look like as opposed to an opposition? And I think that he did that quite effectively.
Well, I just note that in his speech, in addition to not mentioning, you know, he didn't mention Trudeau by name, but he obviously mentioned the government. And then he hit a whole host. I thought he was very articulate hitting a whole host of hot button issues, as some of them you've just mentioned, inflation, the energy crisis, the housing crisis, you know, young people finding homes, people having choice, the intrusion of government in people's lives. He talked about en français, he spoke about wokeism. He had a line in French where he used a reference of the woke people in Ottawa. And he spoke about issues, I think, that are everyday people are dealing with. And there's this sense of detachment. I think it seemed to really resonate with people. I noticed a lot, one of the largest applauses or loudest responses from the audience came when he just said, if he's in, we're getting rid of the Arrive Canada Act. It just big cheer in the audience from that. So he is setting the table maybe in that speech to speak to Canadians. One of the things I found interesting, though, and it was one of the key reasons I wanted to have you on our show, was because you're known as a red Tory, obviously a respected conservative across the country. You've got a lot of experience, as I said earlier. You talked about red Tories and blue liberals potentially coming together. I would agree with you that blue liberals, and those for our listeners, those are liberals who are, I would say, progressive people in the sort of social sense, but fiscally more conservative. Blue liberals, red Tories, sort of same thing. They're the voters that switch parties in elections. That blue liberals and red Tories will often, vote liberal or conservative depending on the leader. I found that your idea that this center in the Canadian political landscape is really important for the conservatives to win was a really astute and perceptive look at at Canadian voting patterns. But the question is a specific question I have for you is this. That seems to be one of the premises in your book, is that you've got to win the center. But if the center, if the Liberals have moved, Justin Trudeau has moved so far left, I would say he's to the left of the NDP at this point. Does that mean that the center has actually shifted? Is the center
Centers,
today not where it was 10 years ago?
no, centers do shift, absolutely, and this is why a party, parties move the needle. A party has principles, and the idea is, as a leader, is that you move the center to you. In a sense, yes, you don't change who you are. This is the whole thing. Oh, you'll be liberal light if you go to the center. No, actually, to me, right now, the center is center right. I don't see it as center left. When you look at blue liberals and red conservatives, or even just conservatives, what do they have in common is that they prioritize prosperity and growth over redistribution. Bill Morneau even complained about this.
Yes,
You
when
know
he
that
talked
the
about the wealth
government,
redistribution
yep.
focus, right?
And this is a huge comp, even in the earliest days with Trudeau, because Trudeau and Chrystia Freeland were on the same page. Her book, Plutocrats, was a award-winning book. I disagreed with a lot of it, but won a lot of awards for talking about how the middle class was hard done by the upper class, and there was a wealth going up and not coming back down. It was the opposite of Ronald Reagan's trickle-down economics. And the argument she made does hold true in part in the United States, where they actually have a lot less social mobility than Canada, something we don't really realize. But in Canada, it's not the case. It really was not the case, especially under Stephen Harper. The financial crisis did not affect us the same way it did affect the US. So her book, she wrote it when she was in New York. She wrote it based on the American experience, but people extrapolated that to Canada. And it was, it sort of captivated Trudeau, apparently, and these ideas. And that's what he did. So as a result, he tried to move the center to the left. He tried to say, this is the norm. The real norm is government gives money to people. And not only because it's a good idea, but ideologically for him, it was a way of making people think government was their friend and they should depend on it. And ergo, they should vote for him. And that calculus, I think, has backfired in spectacular fashion because, in part, the pandemic came too, and people realized that government is not an endless wallet. It's not an
Black hole
ATM
of
that just
funding.
spits out money. Yeah, I mean, we're over $1 trillion in debt, and now with people seeing their own debt going up and with interest rates going up, they're twigging to this again. They're saying, "Wait a minute, this is just not sustainable." And so the center now is center right in the sense people want fiscal discipline, they want a house in order, they want to know the government is not being too profligate. So that's why I say occupy the center, yeah, because the center to me now is conservative, and this notion that we're going to be liberal light is no, what was it's not. It is actually there are people in the Liberal Party who are on fiscal matters quite conservative. Those are the voters we need to get, and he did appeal, Mr. Poilievre, to those voters in his speech. He hit
Well,
only on economic stuff. He did not hit on social conservatism. That is an
yeah,
interesting thing he left out.
one thing I found very interesting in his remarks. Incredible statistic that the Trudeau government has spent more money than all governments combined since Confederation. That was the first stat he came up with. And the second thing that people know is he didn't get into social conservatism. He's not a social conservative. He's more libertarian. He's pro-choice. He has said we're not going to get into social conservative issues, just like Stephen Harper didn't get into them. There's a nexus, I think, between what I would call blue liberals who are, like I said, socially progressive. They're very comfortable with conservatives who are libertarian because it's like, don't tell me how to live my life. Don't tell me what I should feel about abortion or the death penalty or anything else. Mind your own business and I'll mind mine. That's the libertarian view.
Well,
The progressive view is there's a crossover there because what if you're, for example, if you're pro-choice, a libertarian wouldn't tell you that you wouldn't sort of grief on you about that. That'd be like, well, that's your business. We don't get into those social
yeah.
issues. So Polyev is sort of craftily kept away from that stuff. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I do. And that to me, that, social conservatism really didn't get a nod at all. And I mean, if the final results, we know Leslyn Lewis, who's the sole
9%.
social conservative candidate, pulled 9%. So, yes, I think that what, first of all, I would say the interesting thing is you're right. It echoes the remarks of Trudeau Sr., Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who famously said the state has no place in
In
the
the bedrooms
bedrooms
of
of
the
the
nation,
nation.
correct.
And a libertarian would agree with that. There is common cause between these groups, so it's false to say we shouldn't be getting liberal voters. This is the one thing, though, I criticized during the leadership campaign was the demonization of liberals, because at the end of the day, we need their votes. And when Justin Trudeau was elected leader, he appealed to conservative voters. He said, "They are your neighbors. They're our neighbors. They are our friends. They are not our enemies." He said this at his acceptance speech when he became leader. That is something that we need to be cognizant of, is that there is a voter pool we need to attract, and especially in urban centers. Urban centers and the new Canadian vote, which comprises a large part of urban centers, is a black hole right now for conservatives. The liberals have far exceeded the number of seats that conservatives have in urban areas. In fact, it's something that most conservatives don't realize, that the liberals won all 25 of the most urban ridings in Canada in the last election. They won 109 of the top 150 urban ridings in Canada. Conservatives have 23. This cannot continue. So they have to find those voters. And I think Polyev could do that. So yes, if I had to say in terms of who didn't come out on top in the leadership, really, and people saying, "Oh, the progressive conservative wing of the party is dead," and this kind of thing. No. I think really the social conservatives
Dad.
did not get acknowledged in that speech. So I don't know how he's going to square that circle, but that was one of my takeaways too.
Well, let me ask you this then. There's a view out there, a two-part question. The first part is you may have answered it. I mean, basically, I think what you're saying is that you believe that Polyev could win that center terrain now. That's open. That's unheated, unseated, whatever you want to call it, because it is open. But something a lot of people haven't spoken of since the convention and the change is Maxime Bernier and the People's Party of Canada. I recall being at a reception last year, just after the Erin O'Toole debacle, and speaking to this Tory MP, I won't name him, and I was just stunned at this guy. He's really concerned about, well, he had all these formulations about why it was really important for the Conservatives to be careful. And they had to watch out for the PPC, and I just thought, well, no, actually, you've got to get this center vote that you just talked about, or that unseated terrain right now in the center.
What's interesting in the conservative leadership result is Roman Baber, who was extremely hardcore on the vaccine issue. That's, I mean, he got turf from the Ontario caucus over it. He got 5% in the leadership. Interesting. So, those folks, they didn't vote for Pierre on the first ballot. They voted for him. And I'm thinking that people may still choose the PPC for whatever reason, or maybe not. I really don't know what's going to happen to that vote. A lot of them were also people who may not have voted before. This is the other thing, is that Pierre has brought in a lot of people to the party who were not political before, and they take pride in that in his campaign. And it is a good thing, I think, in one sense, that you're engaging people in a political movement. It's important to be involved in politics, in my view. The trick, though, is to ensure that they actually stick around and do the work of politics, because it's one thing to like something like on Facebook, or to support something because you like the cause, but then if you actually don't do anything, it's not real. So we got to make sure those people who got engaged, who maybe weren't political before, get involved in the business of politics, you know, the GOTV, the hammering the lawn signs, all that stuff, the going to the doors, like that, if that can be done, if that can be harnessed, then I think you really will have a serious political machine. And that's going to be one of the challenges, I think, for the party going forward is getting those people engaged and keeping them around for the reasons that he said on his acceptance speech, not about conspiracy theories and not about, you know, opposition to vaccines or this and that. No, it's about the conservative issues of economics and you know, less government, but good government, those kinds of things that I think really we've got to make them excited about in the long term.
Well, one of the things that I thought was you talk about building a political machine. I have to say that by any measure, the amount of money raised by the Conservative Party of Canada during this campaign by the candidates and the amount of people who signed up to join the Conservative Party, I think is record setting. It's almost double the number of what the Liberals did in 2013.
The number of people who are signed up and the engagement is something we haven't seen in Canadian politics before. It's really very impressive. And so I think that the trick will be, like I said, to make sure these folks stick around. But also, there's also the question of distribution, because we look, there's a map that was published, I think it was a Global or which outlet published a map of where all the people voted. Mm-hmm. And engagement was much higher in the West than it was in Quebec, for example. Quebec is a place where the party needs to grow. It's a place we don't have a lot of seats. So there will be challenges, too, in making sure that the number of people that were engaged, that we actually make an effort to engage them more in places where we need to, which has not fully happened, right? So I think that it's an amazing accomplishment that we have all these people involved, but we also have to be cognizant that, you know, it doesn't help us to have them so many, many, many more involved in places where we're already strong. It's still the weak parts of the country that we have to shore up.
Well, you're a regular commentator. Obviously, people would recognize you. You've been on many mainstream media channels providing political commentary over the years. I would say one of the better ones, which is another reason why we wanted to have you on our show. One of the things I did during the Tory leadership convention was I made a point of watching. I was watching it across multiple mainstream media channels in Canada. And, you know, most had the regular circle of talking heads who say the same old things that you'd expect to hear from them. But I noted that on several panels, and this surprised me, several of the NDP commentators were very complimentary to Mr. Poilievre. And that surprised me. And in fact, a couple of them said that they felt that Poilievre had really connected with Canadians and their concerns in a very authentic way. And I thought, well, that's odd that the NDP would be. At first, I thought, well, that's odd that the NDP people on these talking heads would be saying that. And of course, they would add after, well, you know, but his solutions are really simple, which is a bit of a shock. But they seem genuinely concerned that Mr. Poilievre has gained real traction. So I've been thinking about that. And my question to you initially was going to be, do you think that the NDP is worried about Poilievre? But I just want to sort of rephrase it a little bit and ask you this. You know, in Ontario, Doug Ford ate the NDP's lunch in the last election because he was talking about bread and butter issues and inflation and these types of things. Do you think that the federal NDP are worried about Pierre Poilievre because he's connected with blue-collar workers in a way that it could erode their base, or am I off here?
No, I don't think you're off. I think he's definitely, and this goes to Stephen Harper, has written about this too, about the need to engage the working class, as he puts it. This goes back quite a ways, actually, in conservative politics, that they've been abandoned by the political right and also by the liberals. And that they need to be engaged and they can be engaged on those issues. There's also the fact that, you know, Doug Ford here had his MPPs marching in Labor Day parades, put out messaging to unions. He had a few private sector unions support him during the last election provincially, but he's made that effort increasingly and sent out messages like supporting the trades and supporting industries that are much more blue collar, such as mining and resource extraction and things like that, that yes, that is something that Mr. Polyev is also, I see that coming in his rhetoric, and I see it coming in the party's future. And I think it is important to engage people at all walks of life. But yes, there's a sense that bread and butter issues for the working class have been ignored. The NDP should be worried. They should be worried for two reasons. Because one, there is the real possibility that the Liberals will demonize Mr. Polyev. They will try and drag out everything, every sound clip, everything that they think can make him a lightning rod and a polarizing figure, and use it to their benefit to try and siphon NDP left-wing support to them. But there's also the reality that people within the NDP who are looking for a champion of the working class may also, those people, go to Mr. Polyev. So the NDP will be squeezed from two ends, potentially, in the next election, and that will be very detrimental to them.
One other interesting observation I had in these sort of anecdotal commentary by these, strategists and others, Timmy Powers, who's from The Rock, from Newfoundland, great conservative strategist, tons of experience on his own, well-known in Ottawa. He was on a panel with Susan Smith, who's a liberal strategist, and well, she was billing herself as a government affairs person, but she's a liberal strategist in Ottawa. And the question was, how do you think Polyev did? And this NDP person on the panel or strategist said was, to the earlier question, very complimentary. Said, he's done very well. Powers had some observations. Said that was good. Susan Smith began by, I thought, were you listening to the same speech? I mean, it was like she was tone deaf and just started in on Polyev. And it occurred to me, okay, this is the type of nastiness we're going to start seeing from the Liberals, because they're presenting fiction here. Everything she said was fiction about his speech. I was stunned that a serious person would be making the commentary. I mean, if you're going to talk about someone's speech, you should actually acknowledge what they said in their speech. And her analysis was just, I thought, are you watching something else? So it occurred to me that one of the things Polyev had said in his speech is that the government's not listening to people. They're out of touch with everyday people. And then I saw right in front of me a liberal advisor, and I just presenting fiction. And I thought, isn't there an obligation by government to listen to people or to be truthful? I get the sense that this government, this liberal government, feels they know better than other people, that it's not they want to ask Canadians for their opinion. It's almost like they don't care. It's more of this, we know what's good for you.
Yes, and there's been stuff written about that too. The expression is that they are the anointed,
yes,
and the rest of the people are the benighted. And the anointed are there to dispense wisdom and tell people how they should live and what's good for them. And of course, during the pandemic, that translated in some very practical things, as in like the vaccine mandates, right? That's how people saw it from a certain, some people in Canada anyway saw it. So it exacerbated that sense that they were talking down to you. They talked down to you now on another level. They talked down to the West on the energy issue and demonizing the oil sands. They talked down to a lot of people based on identity politics. They talked down to people on all sorts of things. Then came the pandemic and they kept going. And you're right. It's being out of touch and being the sort of superiority complex, I guess, that's there, that really irritates a lot of people, and they're angry.
Well,
they are the ones, because there's an anger base, there's a positive base to politics, and there's a fear base, and there's an anger base. And Pierre Taliev did tap into that anger base, which was stoked by the Liberals themselves.
It reminded me a bit, and I'm curious to think of, I'm curious what your response to this analogy would be. I get the sense, because, when Trudeau came in, it was the sunny waves and what was it? Rainbows and unicorns? Okay.
Yep, was that your comment? Rainbows and unicorns. That was my comment. It is all rainbows and unicorns. There you go.
I thought that was hilarious. In fact, I use that a lot. That's a great, it's all rainbows and unicorns and sunny.
You're welcome.
No, it's great. And it works. It's a great line to use at dinner parties, by the way. It's all rainbows and unicorns with Justin Trudeau, as it was with Kathleen Wynne in Ontario. Kathleen Wynne in Ontario. She won, I believe it was in 2012. She won, or 20, yeah, 2012. She won the election in Ontario from a tired government, replacing Dalton McGuinty. And by 2018, she won the leadership, I think, 2012. Anyways, by 2018 in the election, people in Ontario were so fed up, I think, with her, this thing we've talked about, this superiority complex, this wokeness, this identity politics. They just seem to think in droves, please just go away. Just go away. Stop. Stop. We've had enough. Stop. And yeah. I get the sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I get the sense that that's where a lot of Canadians are today or feeling today about this Trudeau government. I really get that sense. And I also feel that in watching this, that this is something that Poilievre himself has tapped into. People are just fed up.
100%. No, they are. And that is something that there's always a fatigue that sets in over a period of time. But the Trudeau government's done themselves no favors because they do seem tone deaf. They don't seem to understand how angry and upset people are. Now, I have mixed feelings about stoking anger. I think that the issue I have with stoking anger is that it can lead to some very dark places.
Sure,
it can lead to things like people in other countries. You've seen violence. You've seen people getting so angry that they take the law into their own hands and do terrible things. We don't want that to happen here. So I think there's a balance to be made between feeding off the anger or mobilizing the anger, let's just call it that, because people want an outlet for it. They want to know someone cares and is listening and is going to do something for them. And stoking it to a point of danger. And that is something that, you know, all parties, and not pointing fingers, but have to be cognizant of, because there was a lot of anger at Stephen Harper. You know,
sure.
People forget that. People forget how angry he was, burned in effigy and parades by, you know, public sector unions, the whole bit. So people were really angry too. But the world seems to have gotten angrier since then. So, you know, we have to understand that too. And give people at the same time, give them something, an outlet that is positive, and say, you know, there is a rainbow at the end of this.
Is there a unicorn there too? Or is it like a donkey?
I don't know about the unicorns. No, unicorn's a fictional character. Rainbows actually do exist. But I think the Conservative Party can promise the rainbow, as well as you know, help people vent a bit about how they're feeling about this government.
Well, Tasha, I can tell you, you may not know this, but I'm from Newfoundland, and there are unicorns in Newfoundland. You may want to.
Oh, I got to go there. That's the only province, actually, I haven't been to.
Well, there's a unicorn farm in Goose Bay. Probably you should go there. listen, I want to leave you with one final question. Our podcast is listened to by people across the country, but I want to end with a question for you about Ottawa. If Pierre Poilievre becomes prime minister, you know, we've talked about, you mentioned bureaucrats and the public servants who were upset with Stephen Harper. And we've had a massive, massive growth in government under Mr. Trudeau.
Yes.
I mean, massive. How do you think, if Mr. Poilievre is elected prime minister, and if he continues down the path he's on, and is eventually elected prime minister, should public servants in Ottawa and across the country be worried about their jobs or employment, that type of thing?
Well, I don't know if they should be worried. I think Mr. Poilievre wants to deliver good government. He does want to make cutbacks where they're necessary. And so I think, you know, that sometimes entails obviously cutting back on the number of people who are doing a job or a project if it's not necessary. So I don't think people should be quaking in their boots. I do think, though, people should, all of us need to realize, whether it engages us personally or not, that we have a stake in having good government and having a government that is not too big and that does not take taxes from people that do not need to be taken. But tax burden should be as small as possible. So, you know, I think that that should be done by any government, whether it's a conservative or liberal, is streamlining delivery of programs. Mr. Poilievre has said, I'm not going to spend another dollar without taking one back. So in other words, we're not going to hire someone unless we guys fire someone else. But the point is, I don't think he's going to be creating a lot of big government programs anyway.
And,
so
and we,
I think that we should have a government that makes sense. And that, if you're working in government or not, should be the goal.
And just on that, as we know, it was the Liberal government of Jean Chrétien in 1996 that did significant structural costs that turned that got the fiscal framework of our country and the balance sheet back in order. And to your point, made sure there were productive programs from government. Well, look, I want to thank you. What's next for you? What's before I let you go, what's next for you? I mean, you've had an incredible
Taking a really long nap.
go to the Unicorn Forum.
Right, I'm a start a unicorn farm. I'm still talking to lots of folks about my book, The Right Path. It is still selling really well, and I'm speaking to a lot of groups about it within the Conservative Party as well as others. So that's going to keep me busy. My job at Navigator, of course, I am back there now full time. It is a joy to be back because during the campaign I took a leave for a period of time to devote to that and to finishing the book as well. And of course, also there's my family, my daughter, who's excited. I'll give her a plug. She just got accepted to a synchro skating team. She's very excited about
that.
Oh,
that's wonderful.
I want to spend some quality, quality time with
synchro
her.
Synchro skating, right? Not swimming.
Synchro skating.
Because I've always said, for synchronized swimming, I've never considered synchronized swimming a sport. It's a sport if you throw a shark in the pool, but skating, that's different.
Oh,
you know, that's different.
It's quite demanding. And so I want to spend time with her and, make sure that I make up for all the time I've been spending doing politics. So so that's really my three goals for the fall. There you go.
Well, those are wonderful goals. You've been a wonderful guest. And I'd like to end this podcast by encouraging our listeners to pick up Tasha's book, The Right Path. It's, whether if you're a political, if you're conservative, if you're interested in politics or government at all, it's really a contemporary history of politics in Canada, of the conservative movement, of some of the big issues of the day. It's a well-written and very articulate book. And thank you so very much, Tasha, for joining us today.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Dan. Thank you.
Okay. That was the Ottawa Life Magazine podcast. Thanks for joining us. If you liked it, tell a friend. And we'll talk to you next time.